You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 30th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, senior writer for Time Magazine, former member of the New York Times editorial board, Adam Cohen on supreme inequality, Supreme Court's 50-year battle for a more unjust America. Meanwhile, death and cases rise in New York. Trump extends the guidelines, and a Chinese airlift brings needed supplies to New York State. Back in Washington, Phase 4 stimulus is being prepped. And Trump rejects oversight in stage 3. Meanwhile, Trump revises the idea of winning, calls it 100,000 deaths. And in wake of a shutdown in Seattle shows a decline in rates of infection. In New York, our primary has been bumped from April to June. Rikers Island has the highest infection rate in the world. As an explosion of cases hits a Louisiana federal prison. And at least a dozen students at Liberty University, that's Jerry Falwell's university, have coronavirus after returning back to campus. New poll out, Biden is consolidating his Democratic lead, but dropping against Trump. Meanwhile, Trump pulls the reservation status of the Wampanoag tribe in Massachusetts to help his gambling buddies. And also suspends EPA enforcement and privatizes meat inspections. That was a busy Friday. Instacart deliverers on strike nationwide. New York Amazon warehouse workers plan 1-2. And lastly, little pat on the back for Sam. Trump insisting on signing all of those stimulus checks. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Appreciate you joining us. We are in now, this constitutes week 3 of our remote broadcasting, as it were, webcasting, podcasting, casting. We're getting a little bit better at it. Still some distractions here or there, and I'm still working on the set here, but I upgraded a little bit of the lighting, and I didn't bother to shave or cut my hair. I don't know where I'm going to cut my hair. I also just want to say we've gotten so many nice emails, and it is really appreciated. It's nice to hear from folks, and it makes it just a little bit easier to do this under these circumstances when people write in and say, you know, I appreciate the chance to listen, and it makes things a little bit more normal to have you guys doing what you're doing. So thank you very much for that. And obviously thank you to Matt and Brendan, who are working remotely, and Jamie working remotely, and Michael, and everybody else who's coming on. It's of course, Kyle, who has been relentless in his upgrades for us, both things that you can see and things that you can't see. in terms of the way that we are working. And we now are streaming our audio live. Kyle has the ability to just, I don't know, like you conceive of something that would make the what we're doing easier. And, you know, 3 hours later, he's like, I did it. It's just sort of nuts in a way. But all right, let's get to our plugs and notices. We've got a lot to cover today, obviously. And, you know, just a little bit of insight into what we're thinking in terms of the way that we're trying to program the show. On one hand, I am reading about the horrors that are going on in New York City right now, particularly in the hospitals. I mean, obviously, everybody's staying at home. It's a very weird experience, I think, for folks where a lot of this you can't see except for occasionally video, or you see these stories on Twitter. There are pictures of refrigerator semis, essentially, that are functioning as temporary morgues. Tents up there. I have friends who are doctors, friends who are married to doctors, who are all on call, and they're sending back, you know, messages. Mount Sinai looks like a war zone. These are different hospitals in New York. And then, of course, there are reports that this is start to see more, that it's spreading, you know, to places like New Orleans and in, you know, Albany, Georgia. But now it's starting to come across to other places. There's a real concern in Florida because, of course, the governor there sort of refused to acknowledge this was happening. Texas. And you hear these isolated stories of rural areas. Someone from a county upstate New York here sent me a link that had basically the Google spreadsheet that was tracking. And you can see these clusters in small towns where clearly the people didn't take it seriously. And there happened to be someone there who had it. Maybe they had traveled, maybe came, who knows? And these small towns do not have the capacity to deal with this. They don't, they simply don't have the infrastructure. And so we're at the start of something again that I think is going to be ongoing. And we'll talk a little bit more about masks in the plugs and notices. But with all that said, I get a little sidetracked. We're going to endeavor to keep doing the type of programming we've been doing for years. We may, you know, over, as of late during the primary season, we were starting to do one or two more news days, one extra maybe a week. We're going to keep trying to do interviews, some of which will have to do with coronavirus, some of which will have to do with how we rebuild our economy after this. And then others that are, you know, we will return to normalcy or some facsimile, and we will still have a lot of the issues that are were present before, and in many respects, they'll be worse. So we're going to continue to bring on a range of guests. Sometimes it'll be a little bit off topic from the news of the day that is in everyone's forefront of their minds, and sometimes it won't. So that's what we're trying to do here. And, you know, a lot of books got pushed because of this, but we're still working on it, and we will see. Now it is time for our COVID-19 plugs and notices for March 30th, 2020. And here we go. First off, and I can't remember who told me to remind everybody, but the census, you have been mailed the census. Go online or mail it back, whichever you do, but fill out your census forms. Hugely, hugely important. Hugely important. This is going to be a real challenge this year. In addition to a Republican administration trying to make the census as incomplete as possible, this is just going to add to that. So make sure you fill out your census. Roger sends us links to two videos they made to make two kinds of face shields, heavy-duty face shields for medical personnel and disposable face shields. If you're going out, you don't have a mask, face shield is a great way to shield your face. There's two different videos there. Tomorrow, I may actually even do a demonstration of how to make your own mask. There's a lot of data that shows that societies that have been pushing wearing masks have had much less of a problem, in part because we don't know asymptomatic transfer is big, and we don't know if we have it or not. So if you go out and wear a mask, it becomes part of like societal norms during these times. It's much easier. You can make one easy with a t-shirt, just double layered up. But we will, I've seen a couple of examples of it. We will find that out. Also, theprepared.com is a site which is sort of prepper-ish, but very reasonably so. In fact, I had read there about 2 months ago that toilet paper would be the first thing that runs out. And so they have a blog on how to disinfect packages from COVID-19. I can tell you that my practice is not as rigorous as theirs, but I leave the stuff outside for at least 24 hours. And then I go and I use work gloves. I take the stuff out. I dump it on the floor, throw the box, the edge of like the porch. And when I'm done, I turn the gloves inside out. I leave them outside for like 3 days and I rotate gloves. And then I wash my hands. And then I do the same thing with the plastic on the inside if it has been shipped within the past 72 hours. But go there. We've got a link on how you can disinfect those packages. Better safe than sorry. Better safe than sorry. We also have a link from Mike, who provides a volunteer on-demand messenger courier group. They're working on a website, but for now it's an Instagram page. That's COVID-19messengers.com. Soria from Austin writes, Austin's Cow Potatoes Furniture has converted its furniture production line to manufacture personal protection equipment, masks, and gowns for the city. Trying to keep stocks for individuals in the area in need. They're doing it for free. The materials they were using for pillows was certified to work. They're not making a penny off of this, but materials are running low. They're taking donations to fund restocking. And longtime listener M Happy Now is offering coaching services to MR listeners at half rate and by the minute for those who want 15 or 30 minutes due to money constraints. She also has a podcast, Happy Health, H-A-P-P-E Health, and we'll be updating it with tips and tools for those who can't afford anything now. If you let her know that you're an MR listener, she'll give the Sammy discount half rate at $1 per minute, include the link to my most recent podcast, and you can check that out. Her information is below. It's mhappy.com, H-A-P-P-E.com. David writes, hi, everyone. I'm writing on behalf of Luna Video Games. I'm a customer there. I'd like to share that they've been responsibly closed as soon as the same home order was issued. They sell retro-style video games, which are largely physical media and fill a space that helps keep a part of our recent history going. There's a site, lunavideogames.com. There are links for curbside service, merchandise, and a GoFundMe to help employees. Austin says, I create 3D computer models and print product samples. I do parametric and mesh modeling. Business is slowed now that my clients are closing. I can design and print anything. And I'm working on a 3D printer ventilator and would like help for resources to help prototype it and more to work on it. All files of V1 are online for free. I will post version 5 soon. It's printing now. That's at thingiverse.com. As always, all these links will be in the podcast description. Sam and crew, my brother works for a bar in Cincinnati named Urban Artifact. It's been shut down, but they ship their beer. They do small batch sours and fruited beers. The website is artifactmerch.com. I like those sours. Left is best. We also have another link in there for how to make your own mask from Hong Kong scientists. It's at scmp.com. We'll put the link in there. I believe you use like paper towels and rubber bands. Every little bit helps. Refoundry trains formerly incarcerated people to repurpose discarded materials into home furnishings and mentors them in their own business or career. You can check it out at refoundry.org. They could use some help. The soup kitchen in Milo writes, in Costa Mesa has been feeding the elderly, working the poor and homeless since 1986. SomeoneCaresKitchen.org. They're a federally registered charity. They're in desperately need of paper napkins, toilet paper, paper platers, small disposable cups, etc. Adam Ronquillo writes how, has some t-shirts at teespring.com. Stores Ronquillo Designs. Check that out. Freelancers Union has a guide on how to apply for COVID paid sick leave for affected freelancers. We'll put a link to the freelancersunion.org on our site. There's also a GoFundMe for help hourly workers. And another guy, who is this? Oh, Nima, sorry. Nima has developed a platform for crowdsourced 3D printing of parts of COVID-19 little ships of Dunkirk. They have named it after Operation Dynamo. Our platform connects local hospitals to nearby volunteers with 3D printers. These volunteers will 3D print the necessary parts for respirators, et cetera, and send them to the hospitals. Anybody who has a 3D printer can join the website as a volunteer to list available jobs in their local area. You can go to Operation Dynamo, DYNAMO.org. And we'll put Nima's email on the description as well if you have any questions. And that is the plugs and notices for March 30th. If you have some, send us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put into the link plugs and notices, and we will read it. Just trying to get stuff out there for people. In the meantime, you got to wear some clothes. My daughter, she spent all her time trying to buy new clothes right now. And in the world of clothes shopping, as you know, there are no consistent sizes. Why should we try to guess if a medium is really a medium? Constantly have to return clothes purchased online to find something that fits perfectly. Well, Stitch Fix is a personal styling company that makes getting the clothes you love effortless. It's a completely different way to shop that's all about you every time. To get started, go to stitchfix.com/majority. Set up your profile and they'll deliver great looks personalized just for you in your colors, in your styles, and your budget. You pay a $20 styling fee for each fix, which is credited towards anything you end up keeping. You can schedule it anytime. There's no subscription required. Plus, shipping, returns, exchanges are easy and free. Stitch Fix does the hard work for you, making great styles and effortless for everybody, including men, women, and kids. For me, I got a couple of new pieces of clothing that I really loved. And a couple of brands that I had never heard of. First off, Brendan, as you recall, I got my Penguin Monty Modern Leather Chukka. I mean, I don't know what that, I call them like desert boots. But they got nicer soles. They're a little more stylish. When I want to feel like I'm going out for the evening, maybe I'm going to go to the kitchen and have a drink. I'll put on a nice pair of shoes. Also, what I've been loving and probably wearing too much is my Thermal Crew. It's from Aylesbury. I had never heard of them either. And I'm back on the Thermal Crews. up here because, you know, I'm getting a little bit, you know, I'm not going so much collared around the house. And I love it. The other thing, I got a mock neck sweater. Not into it. Not into it. Just put it back in the bag. Sent it back. It was easy peasy. That's the way this works, folks. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. Don't knock me. I'm not a mock crew guy. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Adam Cohen on Supreme Inequality. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Adam Cohen. He is a former member of the New York Times editorial board. He is a senior writer for Time Magazine and author of Supreme Inequality, Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Good to be here, Sam.
So let me just start off. I should tell you, because I think to a certain extent, your book is to dispel people of the myth of the progress that has been made by the Supreme Court across society. In some areas, yes. In other areas, no. That it is universal. I hope, if I've done my job correctly over the years, that skepticism already exists here amongst our audience. But so with that said, let's just start before we get to the last 50 years. Let's talk about the 15 or so years prior to that. Give us a sense of the war in court and where the Supreme Court was from 53 to, I guess, about 69.
Sure. So the war in court begins when Earl Warren, who was then the governor of California, is appointed Chief Justice. And that is this period of an activist court that many of us grew up in school learning about and associating with the Supreme Court, thinking that's how things always were. In 1954, within Warren's first year of arriving, the court hands down Brown versus Board of Education. And after that begins the slow but eventually fairly successful project of desegregating schools in the South. At the same time, they are transforming many other areas of the law. You know, this is the period in which we got the Miranda decision, which said that police have to tell you that you have the right to remain silent before they question you. We got Gideon v. Wainwright, which promised every poor criminal defendant the right to a lawyer. We got a decision striking down the poll tax. We got decisions striking down forced prayer in public schools. So in many, many areas, the Warren Court was transforming society for the better.
When you say activist, I mean, what made the Warren Court activist?
Well, the Warren Court was not afraid to strike down laws or to issue orders to institutions when it saw unconstitutional things going on. So, for example, striking down laws that existed in the South, segregating not just the schools, but, you know, Jim Crow segregated every aspect of society. The Warren Court was willing to strike those laws down in a way that the court had not been before. But also, you know, you look at a decision like Gideon v. Wainwright, guaranteeing every indigent defendant the right to a lawyer. That's a huge thing, right? That is imposing on every jurisdiction in the country an affirmative obligation to come up with lawyers for people. That was an expensive ruling for every city and county and state in the country. The Warren Court wasn't afraid to do that when they thought there was a constitutional right that had to be vindicated.
And let's just there's really two different elements to activism in this context. One is a willingness to strike down laws and really, in some ways, act contrary to a legislative will based upon the Constitution. And then the other is to create mechanisms or requirements to protect constitutional rights, as in, like you said, in Gideon.
I think that's right. Exactly. And these were things that, you know, the court had done from time to time. In the past, it had more often done that in a conservative direction. You know, in the 1920s, the court was being activist to strike down progressive legislation, including laws against child labor. But here in the 60s, starting in the 50s, but mainly in the 60s, we had a liberal court that was actually willing to do this activism on behalf of the most disadvantaged members of society.
Okay. And so that before we head towards like the Nixon era and Abe Fortas, and I want to get there, but tell us about Shapiro v. Thompson, because in some ways, this is like, like in a parallel universe, this case has far more resonance, right, through the years?
What you saw also with the Warren Court, which was amazing, and Shapiro was an absolute example of it, was that the court was willing to go to bat for welfare recipients. This was, you know, the poor were so often disparaged in Supreme Court rulings, and the idea of welfare was really, you know, looked down upon. Suddenly in the 60s, you get a series of decisions, including Shapiro v. Thompson in 1969, where the court is aggressively saying, people have some kind of a right to welfare, and it shouldn't be taken away from them arbitrarily or denied them arbitrarily. In Shapiro, it was a matter of someone who had moved to a new state. They had moved to Connecticut, and Connecticut had a residency requirement that you had to be there for a year before you got welfare. And so poor people who moved there for their first year wouldn't get welfare. The Supreme Court struck that down. Now, there were those who had hoped that they would do it in even more expansive ways, come up with some kind of a broader right to welfare or something like that. The court didn't do that in Shapiro. It grounded its decision on the right to travel. But still, it was a very, very important decision that, in practical terms, delivered welfare to a lot of people who were being denied it.
And I guess my point is that's the type of case, because we're starting to see like analogs of this case in the Roberts court, where you start to slowly develop a line of cases that begins to expand or contract rights in some fashion. And that Shapiro case could have been, theoretically, the building blocks of expanding the state's obligation to its citizens.
That's right. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is that there was a really robust movement in the 60s of poverty lawyers who were, there were many of them around the country, and they were very influential, who were, and academics, there were a lot of poverty law academics who were working with them, who were trying to establish much broader rights. So actually in 1969, the same year that Shapiro v. Thompson was decided, Frank Michelman, who was then a young Harvard law professor, constitutional law professor, he's still a professor there now, wrote a very discussed, article in the Harvard Law Review, the first article in the Supreme Court issue that year, arguing that there was actually perhaps a constitutional right to subsistence, to things like food and healthcare from the federal government. And that was the high watermark. But those arguments were being made. And some people hope that Shapiro v. Thompson would be the case in which the court embraced that kind of broader idea about economic rights. Didn't do that. But as I say, it did still deliver a victory for poor people.
And it didn't do that. I mean, there's obviously, we could never know the counterfactual. But part of the reason why it definitely, there was no chance of that happening, was because of personnel changes on the Supreme Court. So let's move into now the era that you're writing about, or the beginning of it. And this is Nixon has the opportunity to fill four court seats. But talk about Abe Fortas, because I'm not sure that folks remember this little bit of history.
Sure. So Nixon is elected and is very eager to change the Warren Court, to end the liberal court and create a conservative one. And he's literally asking people about the health of the older liberal justices on a pretty regular basis, looking for any possible opening. And he's also fixated on trying to remove them in any way he can. Abe Fortas was a justice on the Supreme Court who had been put there by Lyndon Johnson. He and Lyndon Johnson were old, old friends, went way back. Abe Fortas had been his election lawyer and a close advisor. When Warren goes to Johnson in 1968 and says, I'm going to be retiring soon. The election was going on. Warren was afraid that Nixon would be elected and that Nixon would take over the court. Earl Warren says to Johnson, I'm going to step down. Please appoint a liberal successor. Johnson decides to elevate Abe Fortas from regular justice, associate justice, to chief justice. The Senate rejects that. So Nixon comes in, and he's not only getting to fill Earl Warren's very important seat of chief justice, but he sees that Abe Fortas has been weakened by his rejection from the Senate. And Nixon exploits that opportunity in a really, bloodthirsty and illegal, dirty tricks way. He begins threatening Fortas through his Justice Department with criminal prosecution, threatens Fortas' wife with criminal prosecution. Another thing is, Fortas had engaged in some ethical close calls, things that did not violate the law, did not violate any court rules. They didn't look very good. They provided an opening for Nixon. Fortas' wife had been investigated. She was a lawyer, a partner at the same law firm Fortas had been investigated for a matter involving a litigation that she was cleared of. But Nixon was able to use those openings. He sent John Mitchell, his attorney general, who was later himself in prison for Watergate crimes, goes to the Supreme Court and tries to bully Earl Warren. And anyway, all this threatening, this improper use of the Justice Department, because the Justice Department is, of course, not supposed to be used to threaten people with prosecution to change the ideology of the court. And Nixon was using it as a political tool. It works. Abe Fortas steps down and Nixon gets one of the four, as you say, nominations he's able to get in just 3 years. And that proves critical to changing the court from a liberal Warren court to a conservative one. And in the book, I talk about several very important decisions that were 5-4 in the early 70s, that if Fortas had remained on the court, as he should have, liberals would have won, and we all would have had much more robust rights than we have today.
We should also say, there, as far as I know, there's no, there's very little ethics rules that bind Supreme Court justices. I know that just because I've been following Clarence Thomas's career for the past couple of years, and conflicts of interest and whatnot. I mean, so it's an interesting. I mean, how much did what happened with Fortas inform the way that the Senate would approach appointees, nominees?
Well, you know, the rejection of Fortas for Chief Justice was considered, you know, that was a milestone. And I think it did pave the way in some ways for, you know, liberals to do things like reject Judge Bork down the road. So I think it presaged maybe in some ways a bolder role for the Senate. But I think that, you know, in my looking back on it, the real tragedy, though, of Fortas is all the lost opportunities that we had there to have a liberal court that lasted longer. And what's incredible is that Fortas's name is really never mentioned now. You know, if you go to a law school, if you go to Yale Law School, where he was a graduate of, you know, some say the most brilliant graduate of Yale Law School, he's just not talked about. He's considered an embarrassment. And it's an overreaction. You know, he did some things. The main issue he got in trouble for was accepting money from a foundation that was run by a Wall Street financier, but it was a do-good foundation, and judges and justices actually did do consulting work at the time. It sounds a little strange now, although we do have judges and justices certainly who do a lot of speaking appearances, but there just wasn't that much that was that terrible. But the idea that Fortas is now considered a liberal embarrassment, he's very much a conservative embarrassment, because he's really the main exhibit in how the conservatives used skullduggery to take over the court in 69, much as they used it, you know, half a century later with Merrick Garland to hold on to the liberal majority. So that's the Fortas message that I think people should know, but it's just not one that people are talking about at all.
Okay, let's move on to the cases that follow this right-wing takeover of the court. Cases like San Antonio School District versus Rodriguez that we can talk about, and Milken v. Bradley, and a Bilotti case, and Dandridge v. Williams. Where do you want to start in terms of, in some ways, we have sort of different tracks depending on what the issues are?
Right. And those first two you mentioned are absolutely critical. And I say that, you know, not only because when I graduated from law school, I became a public interest lawyer for the ACLU, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and I worked on education cases. And I was really, me and my colleagues were working in the shadow of these cases, because those two rulings, Rodriguez in 1973 and Milliken in 1974, really closed the door to progressive reform in education coming from the Supreme Court. Rodriguez was a case in which poor Mexican-American students and parents in Texas sued Texas because there were such enormous funding disparities between rich and poor school districts. It made the education in the state very unequal. They made the very logical argument that if the government is going to provide education to children, the Equal Protection Clause says it has to do that equally, because the government is supposed to treat its citizens equally. They won at the federal district court level. Three court judge unanimously ruled for them. It gets up to the Supreme Court, and in 1973, the court rejects their case 5-4. And it, you know, that one of those five votes is the vote that would have been Abe Fortas's, but was instead a conservative who voted the other way. So that meant that all around the country, states were able to continue to unequally fund their districts. And that's very much true today, as I think we all know, that rich districts spend a lot more on their students than poor districts. And there's strong evidence that leads to different life outcomes for children from those districts. Then the next case.
I just want to stop there for a moment because we spend a lot of time on this program talking about the implications of kids coming from poorer districts, lower income areas, and how property taxes sort of perpetuate these disparities in the schools. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff obviously that happens at home when you're talking about lower income kids. They don't have the same opportunities for educational experiences outside of the home. They don't have necessarily more nutritional challenges. But the way that we fund schools is so problematic. So in this instance, in terms of San Antonio School District versus Rodriguez, this would have been a situation where there would have been an obligation of San Antonio, or really ultimately of the federal government or states, right, to basically come up with a different scheme in providing funding for schools, right? That would have been like the baseline. They wouldn't have been able to say, you know, you got to pull it away from real estate taxes, but they would have said that is, you know, you got to come, you, if you want to come up with another way of funding, but funding would be the sort of like first order measure of providing equal schooling to people, right?
That's right. Every state under that would have been required to come up with a funding system that ensured equality. And as you say, made sure that it wasn't reliant on the higher ability of some districts to use property taxes than others. And, you know, I actually think if the plaintiffs had won in that lawsuit and gotten equalized funding, over time, I think we would have evolved hopefully something bigger, which is the idea of ensuring equity in education, right? Because we actually know that if you spend the exact same money on a rich school as on a poor school, you're really still shortchanging the poor school, right? Because the poor school is going to they need more social workers and they need more bilingual teachers. And they have so many more needs. And that actually what we should have is an idea of equity where every school gets funded, you know, properly so that in effect, the level of education they're able to provide is equal. And that would mean spending more money on poor districts. So we could have moved in that direction. It would have been an obligation on all 50 states. And it's tragic that it came within one vote of winning.
Yeah, it's stunning. All right. So then let's move on to was it Milken v. Bradley that you wanted to talk next?
Yeah, a critically important case. So the next year, 1974, the NAACP brought a lawsuit in Detroit on behalf of Black school children in Detroit, trying to vindicate their right to an integrated education, which was being vindicated across the South in the wake of Brown v. Board of Education. And, you know, ironically, by the late 60s, we found that the schools in the South were becoming more racially integrated than the ones in the North, in places like Detroit, where we saw so much white flight that effectively whites were being educated in the suburbs and Blacks were being educated in the cities. So this lawsuit said that these Black students in Detroit were just as entitled to an integrated education as the kids who were getting it in the South. And the only way to do that in a city like Detroit was to come up with a metropolitan area remedy. So it was to say that we're going to somehow move kids around the whole metropolitan area and not respect the district lines, because the school district lines became racial lines. They win that case in the district court in Detroit, and the federal judge there comes up with a really great remedy, which is to create essentially pie slice shaped school districts. So every school district has part of the city of Detroit in it and part of the suburbs as well. And what this created was a lot of school districts in the metropolitan area that all precisely reflected the racial composition of the whole metropolitan area, which was between 70% and 80% white, the rest largely Black. So this meant that everyone would be going to a largely white school district, but everyone in metropolitan Detroit would be getting an integrated education. That ruling was by the Federal Court of Appeals, the next step, and then it gets up to the Supreme Court. And again, 5-4, they say, nope, there's no obligation to have any remedy across the district line. So if Blacks are trapped in Detroit and we're unable to give them an integrated education because there aren't enough whites in Detroit, too bad. So the combination of these two rulings really ensured we would not have equality of education in this country, because one said you don't have a right to equal funding for your district, and the other said if you're in a big city where so many, you know, minority students were, you have no right to an integrated education. And again, if Abe Fortas had been there, it would have been 5-4 the other way.
So those are the, you know, key education rulings that have obviously implications through the decades that followed and continue on today. And I think in many respects also made our education system so susceptible to the corporate reform movement that we have more or less just sort of passed through, and which also did a tremendous amount of damage to our education system. And the other sort of, I guess, I don't know, twin horse of the apocalypse of inequality, as you outline it, is has to do with our campaign finance system. And really what that ultimately means is the failure of politicians to be responsive to the issue sets and the needs of ordinary people as opposed to moneyed interests.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I talk in the book about how there was a world inequality report that came out in 2018 by Thomas Piketty and other economists. And they said there were two main drivers of inequality in the United States. One was educational inequality, which we just talked about. The other, they said, was the lack of progressive taxation, which, you know, the top tax rates have gone down so much in recent decades. And that really is, both of these are attributable to the Supreme Court. And the reason our terrible, you know, unfair tax system is attributable to the Supreme Court is just what you said. It's that starting in 1976, the Supreme Court just begins striking down campaign finance law after campaign finance law. And as a result, the Supreme Court ensures that wealthy individuals and later corporations really have undue influence on Congress and the legislatures. And it really did start in 1976 when the same, you know, conservative court decides that money equals speech. And they struck down, there was a, after Watergate, Congress actually passed a very strong campaign finance law that really would have changed the role of money in our society. And the Supreme Court strikes down half of it. It strikes down the limits on expenditures and says, you have a First Amendment right, rich person, to spend as much money as you want to get someone elected. And that's really been the undoing of our democracy.
Let's talk about some of the those cases and the sort of like you say, Buckley v. Valeo is the most important one. Just give us a sense of what was involved there. And then I guess we could talk about, obviously, that goes through a series of other cases till we get to Citizens United. But Buckley v. Valeo is the original sin in that regard.
That's exactly right. And so as I said, after Watergate, there was just tremendous, tremendous popular pressure on Congress to pass campaign finance reform, because people forget now, but the Watergate scandal, in addition to being about breaking into the Watergate hotel, there were major, major campaign finance improprieties uncovered of large corporations, you know, delivering money to the committee to reelect the president in paper bags and things like that. So Congress does pass this very strong reform. It gets challenged by James Buckley, then the New York conservative senator, and some other people. The D.C. Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., which hears the case first, actually upholds the entire law and quite reasonably says this really isn't about speech. You know, this, you know, that giving money to a campaign isn't really speech. And it also has very strong language about how this is very, very important for Congress to act to protect our election. So that was a great ruling that, from the D.C. Circuit. It goes up to the Supreme Court and they reverse. And as I said, they created this framework that, you know, is still with us, where they said, OK, well, if you're giving money to a campaign, that could lead to some, you know, fear of corruption. So we're going to allow regulation of that. But if you're just spending money on your own to elect a candidate, there's no worry about corruption. And they struck that down. And that basic framework has remained with us over the years, but it's allowed so many loopholes because, as we know, there's now a tremendous amount of spending from PACs and super PACs and rich people on their own to get candidates elected that doesn't need to be a direct contribution to the campaign. And yes, there have been cases over the years that have expanded these, that have struck down, you know, reasonable attempts to come up with other ways to limit the role of money in campaigns. And ultimately, it did lead to Citizens United, which, you know, people know, was taking this a whole step further. The idea that corporations have the right to use their own treasury money and the amounts of money corporations have, of course, you know, are enormous and really so much larger than individuals have, to use that to elect candidates. This idea that they have some right to speak, you know, a corporation isn't really the sort of entity we think of as speaking. We've always thought of people as speaking. But anyway, that created such an enormous new loophole that the floodgates have been opened ever since. And none of this had to happen. This is all the Supreme Court really denaturing our democracy.
There's a whole host of cases that follow there. Boston Bank versus Bellotti in Massachusetts, and and others. But I want to talk a little bit about a couple of other cases that and areas which you write also contribute to the inequality that we have. Limits on class action suits. Let's talk about that a little bit. That is one of my bailiwicks, as it were. Just talk a little bit about how that lends itself to inequality in the
sure.
wealth inequality, income inequality.
Sure. You know, access to the courts has many aspects to it. And, you know, one is literally being able to file a complaint. But you also have to be able to, you know, bring a lawsuit that gives you some reasonable chance of proceeding and winning. So for poor people, for working class people, it is so expensive to litigate and to hire a lawyer and certainly to go up against a major corporation. Essentially, you almost can't do it unless you have a class action. You know, there's certainly some exceptions. But so when women who had, you know, very strong factual basis for saying they were being discriminated against by Walmart wanted to sue, they really had to do it as a class action. You know, an individual woman who says that, you know, she was repeatedly turned down for management when, you know, newly arriving men were, you know, put into management right away, she's not going to be able to hire a lawyer and sue Walmart and get anywhere. She just doesn't have the resources. So those need to be class actions. And that case actually existed. Many, many women who worked for Walmart did get together and brought a class action charging Walmart systematically discriminated against women. They proceeded as a class. And when it got to the Supreme Court really issued a terrible ruling on class actions and said that that the women had failed to show that there was enough commonality to their claims, that even though they were all claiming sex discrimination of very similar kinds, hard to be promoted, they were being underpaid and on and on, on, that because they didn't show that they were all affected by, say, the same manager or something very specific, they couldn't be a class. So, you know, the court issued that ruling in you know, terms of, you know, what does commonality mean in the class? And there's a lot of sort of, you know, legal niceties about that. But essentially, they were closing the door on large class actions. And as I say, when you do that, you really give large corporations like Walmart a free pass, because unless workers can band together in pretty large groups to sue, they're not going to sue.
So is there a way, can Congress fix that? When the Supreme Court makes that ruling that there's not enough commonality, right? That everyone's harm has to be the same, or that the way that the harm was inflicted must be exactly the same, as opposed to the Walmart just sort of turned a blind eye to, you know, managers who were paying women less, or, you know, or was consciously paying women less, but in some instances it was 20% less, in some instances it was, you know, 15% less, whatever it is. But can Congress step in, or is that what in that case, Dukes v. Walmart, is that a specific, is there something in the Constitution that they found? I mean, what is the basis for that ruling?
Yeah, no, it was a federal rule of civil procedure that governs class actions. Yes, Congress could step in, and Congress has stepped in response to some of the other cases we might talk about, you know, other worker cases, like notably the Lilly Ledbetter case,
right,
where the Supreme Court really went to great lengths to deny a woman's equal pay claim. And there Congress did step in, and they passed the Lilly Ledbetter Act. It's hard, though, to get Congress to act on a lot of these issues. And, you know, corporate influence is so great that what we've actually seen was, you know, for decades, the tort reform movement was strongly pressuring Congress to do things like make it harder to bring class actions and to try to impose limits on punitive damages and things like that. So there are some things that it would be nice if Congress acted on, but so much of the pressure is coming from the corporate world and large donors, that it's just a matter of stopping them from making the law worse. And we need the Supreme Court to, you know, stand up for workers when they can.
And of course, we also have, you know, the rash of voter restrictive laws that have been upheld by the Supreme Court. And in addition, I mean, really the sort of, I guess the original sin of that was to gut Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was the formula in which we determined which states needed preclearance from the Department of Justice to change their voting laws in any fashion. And I think we've had dozens of instances over the past 6 or 7 years that the Supreme Court basically gutted Section 5. And you talk about judicial activism. I mean, the Scalia et al. were disparaging of the Senate reauthorizing that act. I mean, that was really stunning. Can you talk about that for just a bit? Because there was no more clear cut of a case, it seems to me, of judicial activism than their assault on the Voting Rights Act. They basically said that Senate was too cowardly to actually deauthorize it.
You know, you're exactly right. I mean, when you look at just, abominable recent decisions, that has to be very high on the list, you know, because also remember what the Voting Rights Act was. It was the crown jewel of the civil rights movement. You know, for years, our country was embroiled in the civil rights movement. Many people died fighting for the right to vote. Congress passes the Voting Rights Act, expressly to vindicate the rights that the civil rights movement was about. It's passed by a bipartisan Congress. It has to be reauthorized. So it is reauthorized year after year by bipartisan majorities in Congress. It's signed into law, the reauthorizations, by both Democratic and Republican presidents. George W. Bush signed a reauthorization and said very nice things about the act. So it's hard to think of a law that was more sacrosanct. And then when you add even just constitutionally, Congress gives the Constitution gives Congress very special authority to regulate elections. So Congress is at the height of its power here. And we all remember Chief Justice Roberts at his confirmation hearing said that he thought a judge should be an umpire, right, calling balls and strikes. So the idea that they would strike down this particular law, it's about as activist as you can imagine. And then when you look at the grounds on which they did it, Roberts talked about the equal dignity of the states, and it was just a made-up doctrine. And it's not just me saying that. Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan as a big conservative, he wrote a piece afterwards in a popular journal saying that the constitutional ground that the court had struck down the preclearance requirement of the Voting Rights Act was made up, that it didn't exist. So the idea that they would do that was just outrageously activist and, you know, clearly results oriented. The five conservative justices just don't like the Voting Rights Act. But then, as you say, they were also in other voting cases, like the Indiana voter ID case, like the, you know, years of cases of about partisan gerrymandering. They kept saying, well, you know, we really have to leave it up to the localities, to the legislature, to election officials. We don't want to intrude and, you know, defend the rights of voters. So it's amazing how they take such a hands-off approach when it comes to maybe helping more people to vote. But when they have the opportunity to really gut the Voting Rights Act, they do it on absolutely crazy grounds. And it's hard to look at the voting cases and see anything other than that. There are five conservative justices who just seem to always rule in the way that will maximize the Republican vote in elections. They are ruling the way the Republican Party wants. And, you know, it's, I think, really, you know, shameful.
Now, the way that the court has been acting really in the past 10 years, more or less, in regards to voting rights is, it seems to me, from my perspective, very similar to the way that the court acted starting in like 1893 and began to sort of in the wake of Reconstruction, began to allow these the states essentially to chip away at voting rights. And in fact, the Voting Rights Act was sort of the culmination of basically saying, like, the court has over the years just eviscerated at least the intent of the 14th Amendment and the, you know, going and others following Reconstruction. What does that say about the court as an institution? I mean, and then I want to pivot off of that as to what we can do about it. Because, I mean, if the court, it seems to me that there's been this sort of like dance, right, where The idea is that lawyers in particular in legal institutions want to maintain and society at large on some level, although I don't feel like the right has done that, want to maintain this aspirational image of the Supreme Court as not political and as being guided by these principles and these laws and the Constitution, when in fact, like it seems to me that the interpretation of these laws is there's a lot of wiggle room in there and it can fundamentally change the kind of society we have. If that's the case, what can we do in terms of reform?
Okay, so a couple of thoughts. One is from the beginning of your question, when you drew the analogy to the 1800s, I think that's exactly right. And you know, one of the points I make in the book is that the Warren Court that we began by talking about really was an anomaly, right? That was a little period of time in which the court was actually standing up for the underdog. But if you look at the rest of the history of the court, you know, before the Civil War, they were upholding slavery in the Dred Scott decision. After the Civil War, they were upholding segregation in Plessy versus Ferguson. During the Progressive Era, they were striking down progressive laws like the child labor laws. During the New Deal, they were striking down the early New Deal laws until, you know, FDR threatened to pack the court. So we have had really a court that has stood up for the rich and powerful almost for the entirety of our history. The Warren Court was an exception. What do we do about that? Well, there are a lot of proposals out there. You know, there are, you know, reasonable people are saying if the Democrats were to win in the fall and to take both houses, that they should pack the court. And that would actually not be so difficult. You know, a lot of reforms of the court require constitutional amendments. Adding to the number of justices does not. It did not originally begin as 9, and the Congress could just amend the law and make it 12 or 15. And then, you know, our next Democratic president could appoint, you know, more liberal justices. There are others, though, who really think that if you do that, you destroy the court, because every party that has a majority will do that when they can. And we then have just conceded that's a completely political branch. You know, and there also is talk about, you know, maybe having retirement ages, because, you know, when the Constitution was written, you know, we didn't have many people living into their 80s. And you know, there was a very different idea as how long justices would serve. But I do think that there's no substitute for just winning the political battle. You know, the Democrats need to win this next election, and they need to appoint justices the way the Republicans have been very good at. You know, it is a battle for, you know, political control of the court, and the Republicans have done it better. They did it better with Abe Fortas. They did it better with Merrick Garland, and they do it better. They time their retirements better. Anthony Kennedy stepped down to make sure that there could be a young replacement for him, and, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer did not do that during the Obama administration. The Democrats really need to play to win to take back the court.
All right. So, Adam, let me just challenge you a little bit here. And I say this as someone who was raised by a pack of lawyers and did a year of law school and still remains, you know, fascinated by all these things. Like, where does that begin? Right. Like you just used examples of how Kennedy basically orchestrated this whole thing to get Kavanaugh on there, you know, and there's been, you know, various different reporting about it. And we could probably argue to like what extent he did. But certainly Ginsburg and Breyer refused to sort of contemplate the idea that they would step down and sort of like put that type of strategy in their forefront of their minds. It's certainly their prerogative. And you know, the idea that we need to win the political battle, but we hear stories of, like, you know, what was done with Fortas and the idea of like Merrick Garland. And I see Chris Coons going on the air, you know, 6 months ago and saying, if we win back the Senate, the first thing we should do is reinstitute the filibuster for justices. I mean, this is like, at what point do, and it, this comes from lawyers, and I understand it, right? I mean, like I say, I was raised by a lot of them. At what point does the sort of the broader institution of law, as distinct from, let's say, the conservative movement and all the lawyers who make up who sort of that Venn diagram covers both of them? At what point do they say we're going to give up the ghost on the Supreme Court not being a political body? Because it seems to me that, you know, you've outlined that at the very least, the Republicans more aggressively gave up that ghost 50 years ago. But I, you know, I think you can argue that coming out of Reconstruction, they had given up that ghost. It's just that the Democrats, the left, they don't seem to sort of be able to sort of let go of that vision of the Supreme Court.
I think that's right. And I think as a result, you know, they're bringing, you know, a water gun to a knife fight. I mean, you know, McConnell has been very clear. You know, he refused to, you know, have any hearings at all for Merrick Garland. And then he went out of his way to tell a Kentucky audience not long ago, of course, if there were a vacancy in the last year of the Trump administration, we would certainly fill that. I mean, he is, you know, he's thumbing his nose at Democrats and basically saying, you know, we don't play by any rules. We're not trying to be ethical or principled. It's all about power for us. And I think liberals need to get more in that mindset. And, you know, you do think about, you know, Will Rogers saying, you know, I'm not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. There's a way in which Republicans are just better at organizing themselves to win power. So I don't know that for a fact that Anthony Kennedy, you know, talked with the White House about his successor, as has been reported, certainly, and did anything like that. But, you know, it does appear that he did resign at a time when he wasn't that old. He wasn't in terrible health. It was the last moment he knew that a Republican president could name a successor with for sure a Republican Senate. Republicans tend to do that, and there's statistics on how they're just much better at passing their conservative seats onto fellow conservatives. That just isn't the Democratic mindset. And, you know, if we want to once again get rulings on behalf of the people we care about, I think Democrats need to think in those, you know, really very calculating ways much more.
I mean, where does that start? I mean, because, you know, the right, their voters are also a lot more tuned in to the implications of the court. I mean, there's as you know, of the myriad of reasons why Donald Trump, you know, but fours as to why Donald Trump won, one of them very well could be because Mitch McConnell kept that seat open. And so where does this start? Like, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, why aren't you, I don't mean to pick on you, but why aren't you coming out and saying, we got to pack the court. We got to give up the ghost. This is a political body. And this, at the very least, will force voters who vote from the center to the left to understand the implications of the court, because they clearly don't now.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And, you know, I'm not quite there in court packing, but I see that, you know, desperate times may require desperate measures. But I think, you know, what we could all agree is it needs to be much more central to this political campaign. Like, you know, a lot of us are very upset that we watch these, you know, debates and the Supreme Court does not come up, right? The moderators often ask some pretty ridiculous questions. There should be much more focus on the Supreme Court. The Democratic candidate should have talked about it more and talked about it in a way that actually got to the swing voter. I mean, in my book, I show how, you know, the court has really hurt the middle class, right? I mean, if you want to be a member of a union, if you want to have a minimum wage, if you want your politics not to be controlled by the richest 1% and by corporations, you need a different Supreme Court. And this should be front and center. And, you know, Biden did say he would name an African-American woman to the court. Great. But how about talking about naming justices who will stop the, you know, plutocratic takeover of a lot of our society? That should be much more in the Democratic playbook every day.
Adam Cohen, the book is Supreme Inequality, the Supreme Court's 50-Year Battle for a More Unjust America. We will put a link to the book on the site at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it, Sam. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Boo-doo. Well, there it is, folks. You need motivation to go and vote for someone other than Donald Trump in the fall. I don't know why you would at this juncture, but if you do, that's a good one. That's the one that I've been harping on. Hopefully, keep our fingers crossed, and he won't be filling another Supreme Court seat. He's already filled 180 plus federal judgeships across the country. lifetime appointments. We already are at a 5-4. You know, a lot of people are talking about that. How do I pronounce his name? Isaac Chotiner? Chotiner? In the New York, in New Yorker magazine, did sort of eviscerated another person in his questions. And this guy, Epstein, is it Richard Epstein, who is a big conservative legal thinker? And Neil Gorsuch apparently is just a huge fan of this guy. And I mean, he's a lunatic. And it's really just a matter of time before these five Supreme Court justices get more aggressive. The worst case scenario, and that happens when there's six of them. And then maybe seven, frankly. I mean, I think it would be stunning if Ginsburg and Breyer made it through another 4-year term. I don't even know that they're going to make it through this one. But, I mean, you know, end of discussion as far as I'm concerned. But your mileage may vary. But are you hopping on? What's going on? I hear some rustling.
Well, Chotiner's stealing your bit, Sam, which is to let libertarians just talk and express themselves.
Son of a bitch. Son of a bitch. Yeah, exactly. That's what it was. And then he just, it really is. I almost feel like I want to read that out loud because it is so hilarious. Maybe we'll do that. I don't know. You know, we gotta think about what we're doing for April 1st. And, you know, tomorrow marks my 16th year anniversary in radio. You know, I'm not a radio anymore. Sure. But. I got one more thing to add to the plugs and notices, and I'll drop this in again tomorrow, but I want to just read it now. Jamie's a good friend had a store called Cult Party, and it was co-op. It was closed due to the pandemic. They're a small business and they run as a co-op. And they were broken into over the weekend and stuff was stolen. They may not survive. You can go and help out this this co-op at GoFundMe.com and Google for Cult Party Robbery. We will put put this in the description, and then we'll read it again tomorrow. They are ineligible, apparently, for most of the COVID stimulus programs because they're run as a co-op, which is also a crap show. Ridiculous. A reminder, folks, this program relies on your support. If you can afford it at this time, if it does not create any financial insecurity for you at all, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. If it does, or if you think it will, don't do it. And if it does, or you think it will, and you still want the extra content because you're sitting around at home, maybe you've lost your job, maybe you're having to care for somebody, whatever it is, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. And we will hook you up. Get it. Just have a little bit of patience. It takes a little while to get through that stuff, but we will get there. If you feel like you need to cancel, go and cancel. We have a couple of different options for you on how you can go about doing it. And no one, this program should create zero financial stress for you. Zero. Don't even, like, if you have to think about it, then don't pay us. We will hook you up and we will get through this. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. They're shipping still. It's a little bit slower, but better to ship it than to go out to a market if you can, you know, help it. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, the AM Quickie, it is available on our app. It is available on our YouTube page. Gives you a 5 to 7 or 8 minute breakdown of the top news of the day. Get your day started right. Don't forget, also, you can check out the Noma Key Show, patreon.com/the Noma Key Show, and also on YouTube, Noma Key Const. She is down in Arizona and dealing with all the stuff going on down there. I watched a vlog where she went into to get a test. She is with her mom. Her mom is immunocompromised. They are staying at, you know, her grandparents' old house. Apparently they passed away a couple years ago. Check it out. And, we'll be talking to Noma Key maybe tomorrow, actually. Also, don't forget TMBS is, tomorrow night, Matt. Tomorrow night, you can check that out at patreon.com/TMBS or on the YouTube channel, youtube.com, The Michael Brooks Show. Jamie, are you there? Well, Jamie, you can check out The Antifada, patreon.com/The Antifada. And Matt, what's happening with you? You've just upgraded. You're just...
Well, yeah, we're going to Zoom record the Widow Ranter episode of Literary Hangover. That's been delayed due to this pandemic, but we're going to do it over Zoom. And also, I will be appearing on the Surfs YouTube channel or Twitch, one of the two. They're interviewing me tonight at 5:30 Eastern. So.
Whoa. All right, we got to take a quick break. Head off to the fun half. Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow,
that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.